Okay, welcome in everybody to episode 4 of the Beast Lore Podcast, a podcast about cryptid creatures, monsters, and the things that may or may not be hiding in the shadows. I'm your host, Jack Daly. Today we are going to be traveling to the foggy mountains and the cobblestone streets of the sleepy hamlets of Transylvania, a place that conjures images of horror in the modern mind. When Transylvania is mentioned, one can only think of one thing: vampires. On this episode, I'm going to go over a brief history of the vampire, discuss some beliefs about vampires, offer some possible theories for why belief in vampires arose, and I will cover two historical cases that have been connected to vampirism: Vlad Tepes, also known as Vlad Dracula, and Elizabeth Bathory. Well, I'm dealing with some allergies today, so hopefully that doesn't cause too much of a problem on the podcast. My voice might be a little bit raspy, and I get hit by that seasonal allergy pretty hard, but, you know, I don't think it'll be too much of an issue, so just please bear with me. So, like a lot of the other cryptozoology topics, my interest in vampires began at a young age. I read Bram Stoker's Dracula when I was in elementary school. The movie Van Helsing came out when I was in fifth grade, and that was always one of my favorites. And if you've seen it, you know, there's a lot of different, werewolves and Draculas in that movie. Van Helsing is in the book, but he goes into a real, monster hunter kind of role in that movie, and I always enjoyed that. Nosferatu and Bela Lugosi Bela Lugosi's Dracula were movies that I watched at a young age as well, and I always really enjoyed those a lot. I can remember that I used to hide under the sheets at the house that I grew up in when I was a young child, about 7 years old, and I'd be hiding from the vampires. For whatever in my mind I had it that if I was hiding under the sheets, the vampires wouldn't be able to get me there, but I can just remember being terrified of them. So they've always had kind of a spot in the fearful aspect of my mind. When I was in high school, I would spend nights and weekends watching shows like Monster Quest and Cities of the Underworld, both of which have great episodes about vampires and about Vlad Dracula. And the historical character Dracula is somebody who I've really just had a keen interest, and it started from this show, Cities of the Underworld, and a couple of episodes that I watched on there. I actually have a replica of Dracula's castle sitting on my office here at grad school, and so, you know, that story is just one that's been fascinating, that I've just found really interesting, and I'll go into more detail about it later, because I think that a lot of people don't really know who this historical character Vlad Dracula was and what role he plays in the entire vampire story. So just to start off with a description of what a vampire is, it is a being that subsists on feeding on the life force of another being. It's usually blood that it's feeding off of, but it's not always. It can also be more of like an etheric force. Energy vampirism is something that's very popular in, kind of new age nomenclature. An energy vampire is somebody that I think that we're probably all very familiar with, because this is a real person. You're around them and their very presence just kind of sucks the life out of you. So that's what an energy vampire is. But, typically, the vampire that we've come to know is one that gets its living by drinking the blood of another person. Oftentimes, I think that most people think that a vampire has to be something that's dead. The dead vampire that is a reanimated corpse that comes back to life to, take the blood of the living. And that's definitely one type of the vampire, but in the history of vampirism, there's also live vampires. Typically, a live vampire it's believed that their soul can leave their body, and that this live vampire will go to a meeting place with dead vampires where they will learn how to do spells and incantations, and sort of they'll learn, you know, the rings or whatever for how to actually be a vampire from the dead vampires themselves. So that's the beliefs that come from the folklore of vampires. There's also a thing called a Varkalok. And a Varkalok, it's said that they eat the sun and moon during the eclipse. And the word Varkalok actually means a werewolf. So the werewolf and the vampire are actually very closely connected linguistically. And, you know, if you really think about vampires and werewolves, there's quite a bit of symmetry between the beliefs and the folklore that surround them. And, you know, I think it's always really interesting to look up the history of a word, the etymology, to understand actually what the first meaning or the root meaning of the word is. And through this, we can see that vampires and werewolves actually seem to be connected. And if you've listened to my werewolf episode, you'll remember that werewolves are tied to witchcraft and stuff like that. And as I've just discussed, through the beliefs of these live vampires having their souls leave their body to go learn spells and incantations from dead vampires, well, that sounds a lot like something that would be associated with witchcraft. So they're also associated with witchcraft. Vampires are actually thought to exist. You know, I mean, belief in vampires is still very much alive in Eastern Europe. And especially in the rural areas, apparently not so much in the city, the belief isn't quite as prevalent in them. But, you know, the stories of vampires have been historical things. And people are actually still enacting these folk beliefs about how to deal with a vampire and how somebody becomes a vampire to deal with them in the first place. So, you know, it's always interesting to think, like, okay, are these cryptid creatures, are they actually thought to exist, or are they just more figments of the imagination? A lot of times it's a kind of complex mix of them both. So, well, to give you a brief history of the vampire, vampires, they probably come from Eastern European folklore. And they weren't always called vampires. In Romania, they're actually called the Strigoi. In Greece, they're called Vrykolakas. And in Albania, they're referred to as Striga. There's also a tradition of things called revenants, which are visible ghosts or reanimated corpses that were revived from death to haunt the living. And so really, what happened is there were these beliefs about Strigoi and Vrykolakas and stuff like that in Eastern Europe, and then they eventually got transplanted into Western Europe, particularly Britain, and then into America. But that was kind of a long period of time that was actually happening over. So, as I was referring to the etymology of vampire earlier, it's actually very contested where this word comes from. Nobody is actually sure, like, what the word vampire is actually drawn from, but it seems to be possibly related to the word upir, which is Russian. And in the year 1047, the first appearance of this word upir came up in Russia, and it means wicked vampire, essentially, is what it translates to. So 1047 is when the first presence of this word appears in writing. Some of my research indicated that beliefs in Strigoi in Romania are actually pre-biblical and could spread back, some thousands of years. But I had a hard time verifying that, especially linguistically. And I mean, that's understandable because these actual written accounts are more likely to come from cities than they are from the rural countrysides, of course. But apparently the beliefs in Strigoi stretch back very, very far in time. So in the year 1196 in England, William of Newburgh's Chronicles tell the stories of vampire-like creatures, which are the Revenants. And like I said, those are souls that return from the dead. And so at this time, the vampire wasn't appearing in England or in, you know, the English language, but the concept was kind of present, and it was coming through in stories about revenants. So in the year 1484, in the Malleus Maleficarum talks about vampires, and it says that they can hurl thunderbolts. So the main passage in that book is about thunder. It says that vampires can hurl thunderbolts, which I don't think that is very present in, you know, modern stories about vampires, but that's what they ended up having there. And if you don't know what the Malleus Maleficarum is, it's a book that translates to The Witch's Hammer. And essentially what it is written by two German fellows, and it's a manual for hunting witches. And this book is really one of the most destructive pieces of writing in, you know, really, really history. I mean, especially in, you know, that millennium between 1000 and 2000, it's up there with, you know, Mein Kampf as far as how damaging of a text it was, because, I mean, it led to the Holocaust of witches that, you know, was happening at that point of time. And, you know, it really was a very destructive thing. And just to make a note about that Holocaust, the word Holocaust is a very specific type of genocide. And basically it means mass death by fire is kind of what it loosely translates to. And that's really what separates the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust in the 1900s and the witch trials, is that those were both, fire was the main way that they killed people. And so there's been two main Holocausts really in human history. It's the Jewish Holocaust and the Holocaust of witches, which occurred, between the 1400s and basically into the 1600s. So if you're ever wondering about these kind of, you know, topics about witchcraft and vampires, werewolves, stuff like that, and you want to learn about the history of them, look up the Malleus Maleficarum to see if there's mentions in there, because chances are there is. There's a lot of stuff in there. And yeah, I mean, it was basically a manual for how to hunt these creatures and creatures like vampires, how to hunt people in the case of the witch, and to eventually put them to death. So you can see, for somebody who is very interested in witches and witchcraft from a sympathetic viewpoint as myself, that I kind of detest this work. I mean, I've studied it a lot, but, if you don't know about it already, take a look into it, because it's a pretty interesting piece of writing. In 1645, a Greek man named Leo Alatius wrote a book about the Vrykolakos, and it talks about how these Vrykolakos are basically corpses that are taken over by demons. And, you know, we can see there the connection to, like, Satanism, and sort of like the demonic forces that were associated with those creatures. In 1657, a Jesuit named Father Francois Richard had a book about the revenants themselves. And then in 1748 is when the first appearance of the word vampire enters the English language. Later on after that, in 1813, Lord Byron had a vampire in his work, The Giaour. And, Lord Byron is a very, very interesting character. If you haven't looked up his life history, I would suggest doing so, because it's very, I don't know if entertaining is the right word, but it's very interesting to learn about his life. In 1819, John Polidori published The Vampire, which was the first vampire story in English. And then 1897 is when Bram Stoker's Dracula was published, and that is really, where the vampire tradition started getting very, very popular, especially in Western culture. That's, of course, you know, the landmark that really set the vampire craze off, especially in, you know, the British Isles and in America. 1922 is when Nosferatu was made. If you haven't seen Nosferatu, I definitely would suggest watching it. It's a very interesting film to watch. It's silent, but it still is kind of it will linger in your mind, I think, after you watch it. So that 1922 is when Hollywood started, you know, getting in on the vampire game. And that's how a lot of these cryptids, you know, it's kind of funny. That's how Hollywood will realize the popularity of the story, and they'll incorporate it, and then it'll really take off after that. 1931 is when Bela Lugosi's Dracula came out, and that was at the time with a lot of these other monster features started getting very, very popular at that point of time. So, and I believe that Bela Lugosi was a Romanian transplant as well, so he was just excellent in that role, and I really think that his image as Dracula is the staple of the vampire image, at least to me it is. 1954 is when I Am Legend was released, and recently, within the last 10 or 15 years, that movie was recapped with Will Smith as the lead, and that movie is also tremendous. I loved it. So I would suggest taking a look at that if you wanted to. 1966 is when the TV show Dark Shadows came up, and I used to watch Dark Shadows with my parents when I was in elementary school, and I always loved it. I tried to go back and watch it recently, but it was so campy and like not scary. I just couldn't really watch it, but when I was a kid, it was scary to me. 1992 is when Buffy the Vampire Slayer came out, as well as Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. 1998, Blade was released. 2003 was Underworld, which Underworld is one of my favorite vampire movies for sure. So if you haven't watched that, definitely go take a look at that one. 2005 is when Twilight was released, and 2008 was True Blood. So, I mean, obviously, you know, vampires have been very, very prevalent in popular culture, and that, you know, 2008, like I said, was True Blood. It's been a while since something extremely new has come out, but you know, they're showing no sign of really slowing down, because you know, a lot of those things are still ongoing. Underworld's still making movies, and people are still fascinated with you know, vampires, especially in their depictions of popular culture. So that's a brief overview of the history of the vampire. Now I'm going to go into sort of some actual folklore about, you know, beliefs about the vampire. And these are some ways that you can test to determine whether a dead man is a vampire according to Romanian folklore. So the first way is if his household, his family, and his livestock, possibly even the livestock of the whole village, dies rapidly. So, you know, if people in the family of a dead body start dying off quickly, then it's supposed that whoever is in the grave is a vampire. Now, I'm going to be going into detail later on in this episode about, you know, some of the explanations for maybe why beliefs in vampirism arose. And one of the main beliefs is that it's actually the result of epidemics and sort of like plagues and stuff like that. So, I mean, that description right there, you can see that if a person had a very deathly illness, it would make sense that their family would die off first, because they were closest to this person and, you know, they would have caught the disease from them. So it might just be just the spread of disease is one possible explanation for vampirism. And I should say also, I kind of gendered it there and said his household, his family, his livestock. Vampires can actually be women or men. So It's really, you know, it's not a man becomes a vampire, a woman becomes this. Either way, a man or a woman can become a vampire. Another way is if the vampire comes back in the night and speaks with the family. This vampire might eat what they find in dishes, or they might even do the housework. And it's said that females will come back to see their children. And then, you know, a third way is a priest will go and read a service at the grave. And if there's been evil, such as, you know, these families dying off or these visitations, if they don't stop happening, then that's a bad sign. Another way is if a hole the size of a serpent may be found at the tombstone. And it's said that vampires come out of such holes. In the daytime, a white horse will not walk over the grave of a vampire. So, you know, if you're going through a grave, or if you're going through a cemetery with a white horse, the horse won't walk over the grave. And then if you exhume the corpse, the vampire will be red in the face. The face will be turned downwards. And that's an example of what's called inversion. In sort of like occult studies and stuff like that, oftentimes things will be turned around to sort of indicate the perverseness of it, and like the presence of sort of evil or demonic, devilish forces at hand is portrayed through inversion. It's said that a foot will be retracted, a foot will be missing, that the mouth will be covered in blood. And if you don't recognize these signs and take action towards them, the evil will go on for 7 years. And these things are, I think, tied to another one of the explanations of vampirism, which is just the normal decomposition process. So it seems that the process that a body goes through in decomposition is possibly tied to vampirism, and I'll go into more detail about that later on in the episode. Okay, so here's some causes of vampirism, some possible explanations for why an individual might become a vampire in the first place. One is that the person is born with a caul. So a caul is basically an amniotic membrane that covers the face of an individual when they're born. You know, I didn't know what a caul was before I started doing this research, but if you can take a look on the internet to see what a caul is, if you'd like to. It's kind of gross to me, but I'm also kind of squeamish with the sort of medical conditions. So, but basically, yeah, it's like this amniotic membrane that covers an individual's face. And one in 80,000 people have that disease. Well, I don't know if it's a disease. It's more of just a condition, actually. But if it's said that people that are born with a caul become a vampire within 6 weeks of their death. People who were bad or did evil deeds are said to also become vampires. Women who, you know, did stuff with the devil, who were a consort of the devil, or who did spells or incantations, are said to become vampires. So again, we see that connection to witchcraft. A man is a vampire if he doesn't eat garlic. So it's always interesting to see if these things like garlic and the wooden stake and stuff like that are actually tied to the actual folklore of beliefs in vampires. And in this case, yes, garlic is tied to the folk beliefs from Eastern Europe about vampires. It's not a creation by Bram Stoker or by Hollywood. And if a child dies before it's baptized, it will become a vampire, and the place that it's buried is unholy. So whenever you're studying medieval Europe, you have to think about the presence of the church, right? So what does this kind of scream of here? Why would the church want you know, this belief in vampirism to be present? Well, if your child doesn't get baptized and they become a vampire, you're obviously going to want to take your child straight away to the baptismal font So really what this is a way of the church consolidating their powers through folk beliefs in the supernatural, which is dubious to say the least. Men who swear falsely for money become vampires 6 months after death. And if a vampire looks at a pregnant woman and she is not disenchanted, the child will become a vampire. So you can actually become a vampire through no action of your own. It can start when you're in the womb. And it's also said if there are seven children of the same sex, the seventh will become a vampire. And that is actually very similar to beliefs in Argentina about the lobezón, which I've researched. And the lobezón is basically a werewolf-like creature. And it's said that the seventh son, especially of a seventh son, will become a lobezón. So there's another connection there between vampire and werewolf beliefs. And then you can actually become a vampire in death, again, by no action of your own. If a cat jumps over you and you're dead, you'll become a vampire. If a man steps over you, you'll become a vampire. So, you know, maybe if your enemy dies or something like that and you step over them, they'll become a vampire. And then if someone's shadow comes over you when you're dead, you will become a vampire. So, I mean, man, that must be really hard doing those funeral preparations and make sure to know where the sun is so that your shadow doesn't be cast over a loved one. Especially if it's said that the close of kin will die. There's a lot at stake there. And it's also said that suicides are potential vampires. Okay, so here are some just general beliefs about vampires. Sort of, you know, some of the folklore that's tied to them. It's said that vampires will meet at boundaries, or what are called liminal spaces, and they'll discuss programs of evil for the year. And especially in Slavic folklore, Eastern European folklore, liminal spaces are areas where you can come into contact with the other side. And basically a liminal space is somewhere where it's not firmly entrenched in one realm or the other. The crossroads is probably the greatest example of liminal spaces, and that's the main place where it's said where these vampires go to, is they'll meet at a crossroads. And of course, you know, that's prevalent in American folklore stuff of, you know, meeting the devil and having a fiddle battle with him at the crossroads. Also the latrine, or like, you know, the outhouse was a liminal space. And I mean, it as if you know, going out to the bathroom in the middle of the night in this little wooden box isn't scary enough, to have also the belief that, you know, a vampire may be able to get you there will just make it even more scary and less attractive of a place to go to. It's said that the dead will meet with the living, where dogs don't bark and where the cuckoo doesn't sing. And they'll go there to teach spells and incantations. Like I said, those will be those living vampires that go outside of their body to learn, you know, the ins and outs of becoming a vampire from the dead vampires themselves. And when a vampire washes itself, it's said that rain falls. And that's one of these ways to figure out if someone is a vampire. If you wash them and rain starts coming, well, that's a sign that they're a vampire. Vampires come out every night except for Saturday, so those beliefs of them coming out at night is prevalent in the actual folklore. It's said that their power is greatest at the new moon, and the shape-shifting bat is actually a product of Bram Stoker's Dracula. It seems that he might have gotten that idea from a playbill, I think it was, that had a vampire in the form of a bat. But it is said that they can turn into horses, dogs, or cats. So originally, you know, it wasn't bats that vampires were doing. It was they were becoming horses, dogs, or cats. And, you know, it's pretty crazy that they were said to be able to shapeshift as well. And then vampires who are witches or wizards can come out any day of the year. So If you're a witch or a wizard and also a vampire, you can come out on Saturday night if you want to as well. Okay, so here are some ways to actually deal with vampires according to these folk traditions. One way is to drive a stake through the heart or navel. My research didn't necessarily say wooden stake, which is what's prevalent in, I think, the Hollywood depictions of the vampire. It could be any kind of stake. And then it's also said that a needle or a hot iron piercing the heart will take care of a vampire. And this is actually, I think, tied into these decomposition, like, explanations for why vampires exist. Because if you were to do that, it would decrease bloating in a body, apparently. And, you know, a bloated body is a sign of a vampire in the grave. So an actual way to take care of that bloating is to pierce a needle through their heart. In Romania and Hungary, there's a practice of laying a sickle on the dead as a reminder that they couldn't walk in the world. And this may have actually given rise to the depictions of death with a sickle. You know, the personification of death with the black hood and the sickle might be tied to this folk belief. And then burial practices should be especially given to those who died before their time, such as suicide deaths, alcohol deaths, or people who are illegitimately born. You have to give them a proper burial or they're likely to become a vampire. And then you can also put garlic in your mouth. So again, that garlic is coming up. And it's said that on St. Andrew's Eve, St. George's Eve, and before Easter and the New Year, garlic should be put on the door and around everything in the house, and that cows should be rubbed with garlic. So, like I said, you know, garlic is actually a very, very prevalent aspect in the belief of vampires. And what this is this is an example of what's called apotropaic magic. And so apotropaic magic is protective magic that could be used to turn away evil or harmful influences. And I mean, I don't know if I've talked about this at length on my podcast yet, but I am, you know, I study magic obviously pretty extensively in my academic studies. And it's very interesting always to trace the beliefs in magic, because oftentimes they're just tied to, you know, witchcraft or the devil, between, you know, people maybe in the modern day that don't really understand the topic or people in the past. But there's quite a variation. And so this would be, you know, white magic as compared to black magic. This is good magic that a folk person could use to protect themselves, as opposed to some kind of harmful magic. And then also to deal with a vampire, I read that you should place their body downward, which is an interesting contradiction, because it is also said that a sign of a vampire, of somebody being a vampire, is that their body is downward in the grave. So that was kind of a weird inconsistency that I didn't really know what to make of. And then also it is supposed that if if two brothers are born on the same day of the year or the same month, the brother is at risk of becoming a vampire. And so that's kind of sketchy, because I actually have two brothers, and all three of us are born in January. So, you know, if one of us dies, the other two might be at risk of becoming a vampire. So that's unfortunate, but there is a way of taking care of this, and it's this folk ritual called taking out the iron. And what you do is you step inside of a circle made out of iron chains, and the circle will be open and closed three times. And while this is done, a priest will read a prayer, and the brother will then be freed of being a vampire. So if, you know, perhaps I meet an untimely death and people think that I'm a vampire, you know, make sure that my brothers know about this taking out the iron ritual, and everything should be all right. Okay, so here are some reasons for belief in vampires in the first place. As I mentioned earlier, epidemics and the spread of disease, I think, is one of the best explanations for belief in the vampire. It's said that vampires will first destroy their close relations, that then they destroy people and animals in the village, then they go to the country, and, I mean, that is basically, if you think about it, that's how a disease spreads, right? It goes from the individual to the close family, and then to the village, and eventually to the surrounding areas. So it seems that there's something having to do with the spread of plague and just infectious disease to belief in the vampire. It's said that a vampire, after they die, they'll go to a place where another language is spoken, possibly also another country, and they'll become a man again, and then they'll have they'll get married and have children. And it said that after those children die, they will become vampires, and that they'll eat the relations of their mother. Which, if you think about all of that in this, the explanation of epidemics, it seems that there's something that has to do with them. And then the characteristics of vampires in the grave can also be, you know, kind of explained through rationality. And I don't like to be that guy. I don't like to be, oh, we have to explain everything, you know, through visible phenomena or through science and rationality. I think that sometimes that's problematic, because as I've discussed earlier in other podcasts, you know, there's a whole range of existence that we still are not even close to comprehending. But one of the beliefs is that suicides and plague victims will become vampires. And, you know, that's because suicides and, you know, people who die of the plague, they're going to have funerals that are done in haste, and the procedures will be ignored. So that's just an explanation of, you know, why their graves will be disturbed and stuff like that. It's also said that the earth will just be disturbed around the grave of a vampire. And that's because if you have a shallow burial and the body gets bloated, it actually can disturb the earth around it. Oftentimes these bodies aren't in caskets, because that's just an expense that is unnecessary sometimes to a rural person. And the body, when it bloats, it can disturb the earth. And then just to go, you know, a deep dive into the decomposition aspect of things. If a body hasn't decomposed, it will be bloated and red. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, that's a belief that's tied to who will be a vampire. There'll be blood on the nose, the body will be warm, and there'll be a bad smell. Those are all signs of a vampire, and those are all just simple things that happened when a body decomposes. And like I said, you know, if the family dies, that's just straight up contagion. If the body can be heard in the grave, that's because bodies will rupture as they're decomposing. You know, organs will rupture, and it will make a sound that you can actually hear. It's said that these things will most likely happen in winter. And that's because, you know, low temperatures will lead to a slow decay of the body. The body being warm is pretty easily, you know, explained, because decomposition increases the heat of the body. And it's said that vampires, their hair and nails will continue to grow in the grave. And that's just something that happens. I remember I was in my history seminar, the final history class I had to take as an undergraduate, and we were it was about the Middle Ages, and one of my classmates was doing her project about vampires, and I said, hey, you know, you're going to want to take a look at the, as weird as this might sound, you're going to want to look at the decomposition process. And my teacher kind of, he talked over me. He said, no, don't do that. And I was like, no. Look up the decomposition aspect, because I guarantee you that's probably tied to beliefs in vampires. So I still am not quite sure why he tried to, you know, put that notion to on the side, but I think that's very much tied to beliefs in vampires. Okay, so let's get into the actual historical cases, and let's talk first about Bram Stoker's Dracula. So Bram Stoker was born in 1847 in Ireland. In 1807, he became the manager of the Lyceum Theater in London, and in the year 1890, he began writing Dracula. The character Dracula in the book was originally going to be an Austrian count named Wampir, but then Bram Stoker started reading these accounts of a Romanian count named Vlad Dracula, and that name sort of stuck with him, and he took that figure and made him kind of the you know, vampire that we know today. And he read books such as Transylvanian Superstitions, where he got information about vampires, such as the fact that they drink blood and that they can be exorcised by driving stakes through the corpses, which were actual beliefs. So let's get into Vlad Dracula himself. He's known as Vlad Tepes, and Vlad the Impaler, and also as Vlad Dracula. And he was an actual historical person. He was born in 1431 in Transylvania, which is now Romania. He was born into the noble family of Vlad Dracul, who was his father, and Dracul means dragon. And so the word Dracula means son of the dragon. And his father was given this name after his induction into the Order of the Dragon, which was created by the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund for defense of Christian Europe from the Ottoman Empire. So in this fascinating book that I'm reading called Realm of the Ring Lords by Lawrence Gardner, it said that these dragon courts in the Order of the Dragon is tied to the lineage of Egyptian dragon courts that originated around 2000 BC. So according to Lawrence Gardner, this is a very, very ancient organization that Vlad the Impaler was a part of. And I found it interesting in Dracula, Stoker says that this character was in life a most wonderful man, a soldier, a statesman, and an alchemist, which latter was the highest development of the science knowledge of his time. And apparently Vlad Dracula attended what was called the School of Solomon in Austria, which was an alchemical mystery school. So I found that very interesting just for my own personal research. Vlad Dracula moved to Torgovista, Wallachia, in 1436, and his father assumed the leadership of the Wallachian principality, and Wallachia is also located in modern-day Romania. In 1442, Vlad and his younger brother were sent to the Ottoman Sultan Murad II as collateral to assure that the father would assume Ottoman policies. And then Vlad returned in 1448 and learned that his father had been assassinated by Wallachian nobles. And so this was when he was 17 years old, and he began to embark on a kind of a ruthless quest to regain his father's seat. He did so in 1448 and then was quickly deposed. Eight years later, however, he managed to regain the seat, and He began to engage in the practice of impaling his enemies on stakes that were driven into the ground and leaving them to die. So he would impale people while they're alive on these stakes, and they would slowly kind of be impaled by them and eventually would die, which is obviously a horrific method of taking care of people. But torture methods like that were very, very prevalent at that time. So I don't like to, you know, make excuses for people based on our modern, you know, saying, oh, this was in 1448 and we can't impose our modern way of viewing things on them. But, you know, obviously it was a very terrible practice, but it got the job done, because at one time in 1462, he left a battleground of 1,000 people impaled, and it deterred the Ottoman forces. So that's really what he was trying to do, was keep the Ottomans out of Romania, and he was successful through his, you know, questionable, to say the least, practices. But, you know, in the West, especially in America, we associate Dracula with, you know, sort of evil things and, like, being connected to the vampire, which it wasn't said that he was a vampire himself. I think that Bram Stoker kind of took the idea of him mainly because of the name. I think he believed it to be something about, like, the devil count or something like that, but it was actually closer to the dragon. But in Romania, Vlad Dracula is remembered as basically a national hero because of his efforts to repel the Ottomans. He was very, very good to the peasant class. He kind of got rid of the ruling elites and did a lot for the people of Romania themselves, or of, you know, Wallachia is the principality that was overseeing. So today he's one of those people that has kind of a duplicitous nature to how they're remembered in history. Some people think of him as Ivan the Terrible. Some people think of him as Robin Hood. I think he's a little bit of both, but I kind of see him a little bit more of the Robin Hood type character, to be honest with you. He was killed in battle in 1476, and after the fall of communism, the Romanians realized that, you know, these Dracula stories were very, very popular in the West, and so now Vlad Dracula is basically a staple of the Romanian tourist industry. You know, I mean, if, at least for me, if you say Romania, the first thing that comes to my mind is vampires, and Vlad Dracula in particular. Okay, let's get into one more historical case. And this is about a woman named Elizabeth Bathory. So Elizabeth Bathory was born on August 7th, 1560, and she died on August 21st in 1614. And she lived in Hungary. And basically, she was born into the Protestant nobility in Hungary. And what she's famous for, well, more infamous, is that she tortured and murdered hundreds of young women. So, this, I'm just going to give you the heads up right now. This story is pretty, it's absolutely terrible, really. She was a serial killer, one of the earliest serial killers. So, if you want to check out, go ahead now. I'm not going to go into too much graphic detail, but, I mean, she is a really evil person, this Elizabeth Bathory. So, I think that she's really one of the most evil women to have ever lived. Her family controlled Transylvania. Her uncle, Stephen Bathory, was the king of Poland. And Elizabeth, apparently, as a young child, showed signs of seizures, and she would lose control of her body, and she would go into fits of rage. And this is possibly because European nobles, they inbred as to, you know, consolidate their power, so she might have been sort of a casualty of this inbreeding. And apparently she witnessed a lot of terrible acts that her family were doing, especially to gypsies. I'm not going to go into detail about what they actually did. You can look that up if you want to. But she, at a young age, apparently witnessed a lot of these cruel acts. And then after her husband's death in 1604, rumors about her own cruelty began to surface. The legend goes that one of her attendants was brushing her hair, and the attendant pulled too hard, and then Elizabeth smacked her and made the girl bleed. And then a drop of blood fell down on her, onto Elizabeth, and she thought that the place where the blood was dropped made her look more youthful. So she started bathing in the blood of girls that she would murder. So girls started appearing or disappearing from the villages and even from places pretty far and wide, really. And nobody knows how, you know, why they're disappearing, but it's because Elizabeth was killing them. And so the accounts of the peasant murders were ignored, but then eventually a noble individual was slain, and this drew attention. So her cousin, Georgi Thurzo, who was the Count Palatine of Hungary, was ordered to investigate by Matthias, who was the King of Hungary. And they basically did a midnight raid of Elizabeth's castle where she lived, and they ended up finding bodies everywhere in the castle. And it was determined that she'd killed more than 600 girls. And this was on December 30th, 1609. She was arrested, and then she was confined to her chambers until she died. So that's just one of these cases that's oftentimes associated with vampirism and with the stories of the vampire, I think mainly because of the bloodlust that she exhibited. And it's kind of a lesser talked about sort of story. I mean, it was never talked about in any of my classes that I've taken. And neither was Vlad Dracula either, weirdly enough. But, you know, you can learn about it. It's on some of these documentaries is where I learned about it. But obviously, it's horrific what she did, unforgivable, and I mean, unlike Vlad Dracula, there's not a duplicitous nature for her. She was just pure evil. Well, that's all for today's show. I hope you enjoyed learning about vampires. Beliefs in vampires are still very much alive in the countrysides of Eastern Europe, so maybe they're still out there. So get a clove of garlic, a wooden stake, and a cross, and you should be good. Beast Lore is available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Be sure to follow me on social media at USU Folklore on Twitter and at Archaic Futurism on Instagram, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.